If you haven't already, explore the many ways to connect with our show. Watch full uncut conversations on YouTube, gain AIA-approved continuing education credits through Arcademy, and make sure to check us out and follow us on social media at Detailed Podcast. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
As architects, the more we can consider, the better, the richer and kind of more holistic our design solutions can be. And so I think in that sense, it's a great opportunity to leverage that. But I think it's too open-ended a question of a process for AI to, you know, kind of come up with the answer, quote unquote.
It is making the barrier to entry much easier. And I think that allows people to have a lot more influence on their design decisions. And in the way that we both deliver projects, the way we design projects, and the way we work. So I'm excited, not scared. And I think it's another tool that we continue to build on as we move forward as a practice.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, senior specification writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guests today are Sam Miller, partner, and Stephen DeMaio, principal at LMN Architects in Seattle, Washington. Sam's approach prioritizes balance between design and technical execution with a commitment to creative problem solving and sustainable solutions. His background in engineering and construction was instrumental in the creation of LMN Tech Studio, a multidisciplinary research and development lab that is nationally recognized for advancing design and fabrication technology. Sam embodies LMN's commitment to architecture as an agent for enriching public life and has led many of the firm's most impactful civic, cultural, and educational works. Stephen brings over 13 years of national and international design experience, applying his passion for innovation to large-scale, complex urban mixed-use convention centers and higher education projects. His design approach results in solutions that are both timeless and forward-thinking. He is adept at fostering a collaborative environment, engaging all stakeholders to ensure the project's vision. He leads LMN's internal teams of project architects and designers to ensure that the design vision is meticulously maintained and executed from concept through construction. The project we're talking about today is the Computing and Data Science Building at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. At a pivotal junction within Stanford University, the Computing and Data Science, or CODA, building redefines what an academic hub can be in an era shaped by information and interdisciplinary thinking. Designed by LMN Architects, the 167,000 square foot facility serves as a unifying platform for research and learning, bringing together students, faculty, and ideas under a shared architectural vision rooted in openness and exchange.
The project was originally called the Bridge Building, and through much of our design process, we referred to it as that. And the idea of it, the bridge, being a bridge between computing and data sciences and the rest of the academic communities within Stanford. And the idea is that, you know, there's computer data science being taught and being researched, but there's also a need for computer and data sciences kind of throughout the institution in all of the different research areas that are happening kind of throughout campus, the med school and the engineering school and the, you know, liberal arts and everywhere else. And so the original idea was to empower and the research and kind of those different academic disciplines with the computer and data science kind of resources that are, you know, they have on the campus. And so the bridge building was conceived of as an interdisciplinary research facility where you would generate, you know, research teams with other academic disciplines and combine them with computer and data scientists to kind of give them the resources they needed to address the research challenges they were facing.
From the beginning, it was clear that the next couple of decades are going to be leveraged by computational ideas. And the data science has kind of spread through all of the academic disciplines, whether that is today or tomorrow. The project plan to put research at its top. So that comes with office spaces, meeting spaces, both medium, small, large, creating a space for general classrooms to meet that serve the entire campus, but also thinking about its connection to Palo Alto and to the greater community of bringing in industry relations to kind of an event space at the top of the building, which we call the public meeting room, and starts to create a new home for three of the separate buildings adjacent to the project.
Separate sessions within several factions of the academic community inform the program through themed workshops. These workshops acted as a vital stepping stone to meld all aspects of the interdisciplinary design.
The programming and planning process was rigorous. We spent many months working through engagement with kind of all the different stakeholders. We had separate sessions with faculty, with students, with staff, with researchers, with teachers, people teaching, all of the different kind of needs that were reflected within the building. There were also two colleges involved in this, so it was, you know, it was interdisciplinary. And so the starting point was kind of individual meetings with the different user groups to kind of identify in a traditional way kind of what their needs might be. Very quickly we moved into what we call themed workshops, which are, we're kind of bridging across the different user groups to find commonalities of what their needs were going to be around research, around community and gathering and collaboration and teaching and other kind of uses within the building. And the themed workshops were really great because they started to break down the silos a little bit and look for common elements or common needs that the building was needing to address that could address numerous user group needs, but also do it in a way that was flexible and could kind of cross over the different user groups' needs. And for them to see that there were other users within the building that had similar needs and interests, and that could be revealing in and of itself. So, and then from that, we started doing scenario planning to test kind of different ideas and different ways of arranging the program and developing stacking and, you know, blocking and stacking diagrams to test kind of different options, and fairly quickly landed on a partee or a diagram where we had individual research areas adjacent to faculty offices or collaborative workspaces, but then also a really important element, which is what we call the hive, which is the element that bridges across all these different areas, both horizontally and vertically, to create kind of a mixing zone where people will gather or run across one another when they're getting coffee or moving up and down the stairs to make those kind of serendipitous discoveries and connections that are so critically important to interdisciplinary research. But how do you make this work, you know, kind of in the fast-changing kind of realm? adaptability and flexibility was key. And so creating collaboration spaces that could be, you know, changed over time, digitally rich environments with lots of different audiovisual opportunities. But then I think also this Hive space that I mentioned is an important part of that, because that's this flexible collaboration zone that can, it opens into meeting rooms, but it also opens into kitchen areas, and it really allows kind of a variety of different ways to use the building and the spaces that hopefully over time will address kind of some of the changing landscape that they'll be looking at.
Situated at the intersection of Lomita Mall and Jane Stafford Way, CODA occupies a symbolic and strategic center. Its placement reflects a broader institutional shift, the recognition that computation and data are no longer confined to a single field, but are foundational across engineering, the humanities, and the sciences.
The site is located at the corner of Jane Stafford Way and Lomita Mall, which is adjacent to the historical main quad and the adjacent old chemistry building. This kind of created that ideal location between both honoring tradition and history, but also looking forward in the future. It's adjacent to the computer science buildings, across the street from some humanities and statistics buildings. So it's really a culmination of all of the bridging that they wanted to do academically and research. So it's an exciting location. While it comes with its challenges, there's also a lot to learn from the history of the campus and the master planning over time and the materiality. So we took a lot of influence from history, but how do we interpret that into a contemporary way? Building area requirements and large open lots are becoming increasingly rare, and this was no exception. It challenged us to think creatively on how to use below grade space. And I think when you dissect that, it's really about how do people interact with natural daylight. So because we have such a tight site and there's large classroom programs, we designed a southerly exposed what we call a garden court. So the garden court terraces from grade all the way down to the garden level, not a basement, it's a garden. And it's forced us to kind of create those outdoor spaces for those collaboration, serendipitous interactions, but also get daylight deep into interior study spaces in the classrooms. So we're navigating grade and using that as an advantage, taking the below grade space to maximize our above grade space, and something that you might not necessarily typically see in a more kind of stacked configuration.
Yeah, I think it's an amazing site, as Stephen alluded to earlier, and it's really at this important intersection kind of within the campus. So it's a really important piece of the building and the design solution. It's on, you know, kitty corner from the old historic main quad. It's next door to what's called Old Chem or the SAP Center, which is one of the early historic buildings on campus. But it also, towards the back, is adjacent to the engineering quad and the medical school, which is much more contemporary in its approach. So there's really kind of two distinct sides to the building that we wanted to be sure to be responsive to. There's also a future quad, science quad, that's going to be happening that this building will be a part of a little ways into the future. And then lastly, some really important, significant existing trees, including oak trees, which are very important to the campus context and community. And so all of that needed to be, you know, kind of very thoughtfully integrated into the design solutions that we were exploring.
On the exterior, CODA responds thoughtfully to its context while projecting a forward-looking identity. Vertical terracotta panels echo the material character of Stanford's historic architecture, while also serving as high-performance shading elements that enhance comfort and reduce energy loads.
Stanford has a rich history in both terracotta, precast, and stone, and they have their craftsmanships and artisans that are working to both maintain the integrity of the materials that they have on campus, but also in terms of how they treat their stained glass, And we've had the privilege of really meeting with them and understanding the color ranges that they use and the different types of finishes. And the facade starts to honor those traditional use of materials that you found that are found around campus, but it's taking advantage of more contemporary ways of building. So we're integrating the terra-clad precast on the eastern edge, which starts to have deep punched windows and scaled openings that speak to the historic campus, that really strengthens its relationship to the main quad and to the SAP Center. And then as it kind of starts to unravel and move across the building, it kind of changes its weight. It's picking up on proportions that's from precast to a light veil of deep terracotta baguettes that are suspended off of the curtain wall system that then move to a more organic curved shape facade that are integrating horizontal sunshades to help reduce solar gain and add scale and texture. So we're really looking at proportions of what is found on campus and then thinking about our orientations, thinking about color, scale, texture, and kind of creating a contemporary system.
The interior unfolds as a layered environment designed to support a spectrum of interactions.
Starting at the garden level, which is below grade but opens out to a large outdoor terrace, sunken terrace, there are the main primary classrooms. There are some large classrooms on that level, as well as student and seminar rooms, team rooms, teamwork rooms, TA coaching rooms, things like that. So it's a kind of student-oriented space typically. And then moving up through the building on level one, the ground level, there's a coffee shop, critically important. I'm not a coffee drinker, but I've been told it's the best coffee on campus. There's always a line. That's helpful for attracting a crowd. And in fact, this building has gotten great use by the entire student community, not just for computer and data science students. And then there's a large seminar room on that floor, administrative offices, and then that's where the research floor kind of begin. And then levels two and three are primarily research floors with those offices and collaboration spaces, as I mentioned, and then the hive space kind of bridging across them to connect them. And adjacent to the hive space, as I said, there's meeting rooms, conference rooms, and kitchen area. And all of those kind of open out into the hive. So you can do larger events by opening those spaces up with operable partitions. But you can also, they're glazed partitions, so you can see into those rooms. So as you're moving through the building, you can see if somebody's giving a seminar on some interesting topic that's relevant to what you're doing research on, that might catch your eye and have you pause and take a look at what's going on there. So there is very intentional kind of transparency and opportunities to share what's happening. And then on the fourth floor is partly research, but is also a large public gathering space, large conference room or meeting room for a couple hundred people, and a similar kind of commons area and outdoor terrace with a view to the foothills, which is quite nice.
Filled with daylight and framed by transparent edges, the hive invites visibility and connection, encouraging occupants to engage across disciplines and levels. Central to this space is a bold sculptural stair that cuts through the atrium, establishing both a visual anchor and a conduit for movement.
It really is the heart and soul of the building because it's the intersection point. And as I mentioned, it's both horizontal and vertical because it connects the two wings of the building horizontally, but it also connects, you know, all of the floors through that very kind of signature stair, the red stair. And the stair is a feature stair that is, you know, part of the kind of the brand of the building, but it's also a really great opportunity for people to, you know, pass one another and connect and, like I said, make those serendipitous connections that are just so important to kind of interdisciplinary research and making those connections that might not seem obvious until you happen to, you know, have a conversation with a colleague that prompts a way of thinking about something. So the hive is really the heart and soul of what we're trying to do, and I think has been very successful. It's always highly activated in day and night. another aspect of having all that glazing into the meeting rooms and conference rooms off of the hive is a safety issue. You know, this building is used well into the night, into the evening, and students are, you know, crunching long hours, and having visibility and kind of a sense of, you know, eyes on the spaces is also a really important kind of safety aspect for people to feel comfortable there as well. I think the other area worth noting of particular resonance, for me at least, is the outdoor spaces adjacent to the building. There's several of them, and they're all slightly different orientations. One is north facing, one is south facing, below grade, or, you know, sunken versus at grade. And then there's a roof terrace that has, as I said, a view to the foothills. All of those are really great, and taking advantage of the California climate and letting people kind of spill out, but having these different orientations that creates little microclimates that give people the opportunity to find a warm place if they're looking to be warm, and or a cooler space if it's warm out. So having kind of that variety of outdoor spaces really makes this an indoor-outdoor building that people can kind of, you know, expand the use of, and the landscape and the old trees that I mentioned are just really terrific. And it's a great opportunity to just spill out to take advantage of that temperate California climate.
The project's aesthetics encompass functionality with striking design, with geometric acoustic treatment and soft baffles that encourage movement and play within the communal spaces.
You know, I think there are three kind of themes. And both from a aesthetic point of view, but also from a functional point of view. So I think we can start with what you call the big disc in the public meeting room up high in the sky. So that's the beacon. And that beacon is seen way outside the building from a distance. It's color controlled, it's acoustic, it's hiding lights and projectors. There's function in the design. But also thinking about it as this is kind of where everyone is meeting. Everyone on campus can book this space. People in the area can come and have industry events. So it's both as much inward focus as it is outward focused. Then you're breaking down the scale a little bit in terms of kind of the gathering spaces where you have the hexagons and the ceiling, triangles, if you break it all the way down into kind of the basic structures, create that sense of canopy and acoustics. So we're finding ways to integrate soft materials with the open ceiling. We really wanted it to feel like it's a working laboratory. So it's weaving those different departments together. So those kind of tidbits of soft space connect with its function, which is kind of the open study spaces to break out into. And then there's the kind of hive, which is the east-west orientation and vertical orientation where you have the suspended baffles. So there's this unique identity on the outside based off of the building's orientation to the site, but it's still functioning as one research building that's looking to weave together people across the sides of the building, across research neighborhoods. So you get that movement in those baffles as it kind of slices and moves and kind of unifies in the middle of the hive. So there's kind of a more refined version at that ground level with a wood version of that. You move up into the building where you're kind of wanting the more acoustically soft spaces, but creating that kind of sense of motion and colliding of ideas that promotes the exchange of raw ideas and encourages play. We forget that there's so much that comes out of playing together, and it creates this intimate yet scalable sense for a variety of different scales.
I would build on Stephen's use of the word playful, because I think, you know, Stanford students and researchers are very serious people and they're very kind of goal driven. And I think having kind of some lightheartedness is important to kind of lighten the intensity of what people are up to. And I think the ceiling treatments and some of the furniture selections are meant to, you know, offer that not take itself too seriously.
It's a working laboratory for research, you know, in scientific ideas. So it has an underlying rawness to the space that is balanced by softness in your footfall and your material selection for your furniture. So there's the woven cardinal red throughout the Stanford red, throughout the entire building, there's the idea that you feel connected with the integration of art that's present in the stairwell. And there's hidden 8-bit binary code language in the stair perforation pattern. So there's this sense of discovery. So there's a lot of small little interior design focused moves to bring the whole story together. But we also understand that they need to have control over their spaces. They want it to be adaptable. They want it to be flexible. They want to move tables around. They want to get in front of a whiteboard. They want to collaborate. And we need to respect the way that they research. So all in all, it's to create an environment that feels freeing, and while also supporting kind of the rich research that they're doing.
Guided by rigorous daylighting and energy standards, the design prioritizes both environmental performance and occupant well-being.
From a HVAC standpoint, we started with two really important pieces. One is Stanford's central utility plant is new and one of the most efficient in the country, and that obviously brings great benefit. So we wanted to leverage that to the degree we could. And then as well, we always start our design projects with kind of a look at passive systems and a very efficient envelope, and before we start applying active, you know, mechanical systems. So we did a lot of analysis on the exterior envelope for solar heat gain, access to daylight and views, and kind of finding that right balance of an efficient envelope that still gives a great experience when you're inside the building. But so we have terracotta fins and punched openings with deeper recesses that are providing shade and kind of optimizing the envelope in that regard. Once that was done, you know, the systems on the within the building, mechanical systems, are actually relatively straightforward systems because they're kind of leveraging the benefits we've gained through the plant and through the envelope. On the electrical side, it is quite robust on the power and the data side. There's no data center within the building, but there is very robust kind of network infrastructure to support things going into the future that we need to be adaptable and flexible and accommodating the unexpected needs that are going to be coming down the pipe. So there is a very robust IT and power data infrastructure in place to support that.
Beyond sustainability, one of the first things we heard was these offices have to be as good or not or better as their homes. This is at the peak of the pandemic. People were really wanting to interact again, but they really fell in love with their homes again too. So it's not just about how you meet your sustainability goals. Stanford has high aspirations. They have their own requirements. We've collaborated with Atelier 10. We have our in-house sustainability director, Chell. And we focused on those few things is how do we make this better from a living perspective? And the sustainability perspective, it was about the reduction of our energy performance, focusing on occupant experience and comfort, water conservation, all the way down to specifying different fixtures, how we're diverging waste and building resiliency in terms of the 100-year flood, planning and working close with civil engineers and landscape, but more importantly, thinking about passive conditioning. We made decisions to provide natural ventilation for every office in the building, which is almost the entire perimeter, has at least one or two operable windows, which is huge. You know, I think we forget those human aspects of design sometimes. And I think the pandemic had us reevaluate our priorities of how we want to live and how we want to work. So we're sustainable in recreating that, the importance of the human experience. And that was at the forefront of the decision-making of the building. You know, as Sam mentioned, all the way down to strategic positioning of the sunshades, both vertical and horizontal, making sure we have the right glazing ratios, but not compromising on the connection to the exterior. Everyone wants to be able to open a window and get that fresh air, but also close it if you have different preferences, right? So taking advantage of exterior spaces, as Sam mentioned earlier, and really creating a holistic environment to both work and live.
Stanford for this building was in early days on their carbon initiative to try and reduce carbon, both operating and embodied carbon. We have particular expertise in carbon with our Path to Zero Carbon series, and so we were able to provide them with some good thinking about how to approach that. And we did do a carbon analysis, and we were doing everything we could to reduce carbon, both, again, both operational and embodied carbon on the project. And that was a priority for Stanford as well.
The sheer scale of combining and accommodating all possible interdisciplinary interactions of the Hive revealed the project's most daunting design challenge.
The Hive helped facilitate that answer every day. And it's really that we're bringing people from diverse backgrounds and different research programs with different agendas, coming from different buildings, working with different people, and you're trying to get them to interact with each other. And you're trying to both create those serendipitous moments, but you also know that we have to choreograph those opportunities for people to both interact across the building that historically didn't interact with before. And the Hive Stair acts as that conduit that stitches the research neighborhoods together. The decision to do the double switchback stair really strengthens the east and west connection on every level. And it was a challenge because there's specific program requirements. There's a number of offices that you have to make sure you're including. So how do you choreograph that experience? So that Hive Stair really unlocked the ability to feel connected as you move across the building, both and up and down. And in addition to that, it was anchored by artist Camille Utterback, and Stanford's commitment to integrate art into the project was really influential. So you can, there's these triangle layered etched glass that's projected on, that's changing throughout the day, that can be programmed to change over time. So we're creating a holistic art infused vertical connector at the heart of the Hive.
Several factors demanded careful consideration during the construction phase, including the site's complex layout, oak tree protection measures, and a sense of flexibility that extends from the design phase through to execution.
It was a very tough site from a construction standpoint. Whiting Turner was the builder. They did a really great job of, you know, being very thoughtful and careful about safety and also tree protection, another really important kind of element, because we had these very significant trees, particularly the oak trees, very close to the site and the building that needed to be taken into consideration. And all of that went very, very smoothly. I think kind of more broadly, just backing up, I mean, we see construction administration as an opportunity. We like to say that, you know, it's a design phase, just like all the other design phases. And it's not that our documentation isn't complete, but there's always, as you said, something to learn. And we believe strongly in working with trades, both in pre-construction, but also, you know, in construction, as they're working on things, they have ideas of better ways of resolving, you know, kind of detailed conditions. And we're really open to that. And I think we want to, you know, learn from the people who are the experts doing the work every day. We also have a shop. We do large-scale mock-ups. We have a 7,000 square foot shop adjacent to our office, where we do large-scale fabrication, mock-ups, prototyping, because we're believers that making things should inform the design process. And that carries down to the CA effort as well. We want to learn from the people who are the best at doing what they do. So I think, you know, we embrace CA as, you know, a chance to learn and continue to grow. We want our documentation to be as comprehensive as complete as it can be. But as you said, there's always some, you know, where this turns the corner, what's the best way to terminate that flashing or that, you know, brick course or whatever it is. And we're always wanting to kind of hear from the people on the ground in terms of what they think the best way to solve a problem might be.
For Sam and Stephen, detailed preparations across the board provided peace of mind, especially as the design process unfolded amid the uncertainties of the pandemic.
Mock-ups, 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 mock-ups. visual mockups, probably more than I ever anticipated, in the best way possible. You know, terracotta has a natural variation in color once it's fired, and there's going to be variations. Whether you design with it or against it, you have to account for it. And we're talking about delivering a building for Stanford University, where the artistry and craftsmen have worked for generations. And during the fabrication construction, we worked closely with the campus architect, contractor, and subcontractor to create install patterns, to group piece count by color variation, to making sure they're packaged accordingly prior to leaving the facility in Germany, all the way down to creating color maps and designing, all the way down to three different variations of acceptable tolerances. So we navigated this from early mockups, and we coordinated it through the construction process. And it's important.
For me, I think this project, as Stephen mentioned, started and almost the entire design process was in the pandemic. And that was in and of itself a pretty significant learning curve for everybody who lived through that and was trying to, you know, do projects. And I think that it was actually a really interesting, you know, kind of opportunity. And I think many architects have discovered this, that we did get through it and we could make it work. And using, you know, kind of new technologies and understanding kind of and thinking about different ways of collaborating, using different tech, you know, software platforms that allow for kind of collaboration in real time or communication in real time. And there was a lot that we needed to kind of pivot to and embrace. And now in hindsight, it feels like it was, you know, just kind of meant to be. And we're all continuing to use a lot of those tools on a day-to-day basis. But at the time, we were really kind of like, okay, how are we going to make this work? And kind of figuring it out on the fly. And I took a lot away from that. I felt like it demonstrated kind of our resilience and our kind of capacity to, you know, find ways to work together. And if anything, you know, LMN, we're a single office in Seattle and we work nationally. So we collaborate with on all our projects, you know, throughout the United States. And I think it's made us better collaborators because we now have ways, tools to kind of connect with clients and our local partners in ways that we weren't as good at before. And I think that's been a great takeaway for us.
As both a physical structure and a conceptual framework, the Computing and Data Science Building stands as a testament to the evolving nature of education and research, an environment designed not just to house ideas, but to actively bring them together. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insight from our guests about the greater industry. I was curious what Sam and Stephen thought about how AI and the lightning-fast technology developments we are experiencing will affect both architecture and the buildings we design.
I feel like, you know, it is changing rapidly and it's really hard to know, you know, where this is going to go because it is every day it feels like something new and different is coming along. I do feel really bullish about it for the architecture that, you know, our jobs aren't going to be replaced. I think, you know, architecture is a creative endeavor. I think AI has a really important role in the work that we do in helping us synthesize and analyze and kind of consider options, but I don't think it's a solution-driven platform for us right at the moment, at least. I don't think it's well suited to create, you know, the design answer, but I think it is a really important tool for kind of testing and kind of looking at all the range of kind of considerations and things. And, you know, as architects, the more we can consider, the better, the richer and kind of more holistic our design solutions can be. And so I think in that sense, it's a great opportunity to leverage that. But I think it's too open-ended a question of a process for AI to, you know, kind of come up with the answer, quote unquote.
I agree with Sam. It's a tool in our toolbox. But it's quite exciting, actually. And I think the biggest takeaway that I have at the moment is the entry level to understanding and dissecting complex problems is lowered with recent advances. And being able to understand how to model wind and model different solar analyses down to building your own in-house tools for area tracking, to exploring different materials and visualization tools. It is making the barrier to entry much easier. And I think that allows people to have a lot more influence on their design decisions and in the way that we both deliver projects, the way we design projects, and the way that we work. So I'm excited, not scared. And I think it's another tool that we continue to build on as we move forward as a practice.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Sam and Steven. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires a mark that you want to leave on this world.
It's about people. And for me, it's the importance of building an inclusive environment for a healthier social ecosystem. You know, it's essential to our practice and our design approach, but it's important to me that we prioritize our shared humanity and humility. And I think if we can continue to build on that, we're going to deliver better buildings. We're going to create better public spaces. We're going to impact the world, not just in the built environment, but in a social, economical way. And I think when we break it down all the way down to just people and humanity and humility is we'll always win.
As architects, we have an obligation to, you know, address the kind of pressing needs right now that are happening right now. I kind of think of architecture as a lever. You know, what we're doing is creating buildings that allow people to change the world. And so I think we need to be as responsible as we can in the work we do, with it being highly sustainable and low carbon, highly functional and adaptable over time, some of the things we've touched on today. But ultimately, it's enabling the people who use our buildings to do the work they do to, you know, change the world. And I have no doubt that a lot of these researchers and students at Stanford are going to go on to amazing things. And, you know, so in a way, it's a lever. We're using a small effort on our end to kind of enable them to create big change down the road. And that's what gets me up in the morning.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.